gonna be scary. Not for us.
All engine running. Liftoff.
To Hart on Thompson, steps right, shoots for the win of three. He got it! He got it!
This ain't my first rodeo.
Westbrook to the basket. Turns Schroeder around. Russell Westbrook.
House the three and the lead, you betcha.
Covington, biggest shot of the game, and he hits it. The corner, P.J. Tucker. Gordon by Gordon Rich.
It's time to accomplish something together that we haven't accomplished before.
We both understand that we have one common goal, and that's to win a championship, so.
Let's get it.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. As always, I am your host, Jackson Gatlin. You find me on Twitter at JT Gatlin. You can also find our show on Twitter, of course, at Locked On Rockets. And you guys know the drill. If you appreciate what we do here, do me a favor. Subscribe to us. Like us. Leave us stars. What else? Can you share it? Yeah, share us. That's a good one. Share us all over your social media. I would sincerely appreciate that. Tell mom, tell pops, tell your brother, tell your sister about the podcast. That way we can keep the podcast going strong every single day. Now, without further ado, we've got our mailbag edition podcast. So this is the second mailbag of the season. I do apologize for taking so long to do another mailbag. Just couldn't quite find the right time to do it. And joining me today to do this Rockets mailbag will be Rockets Wire editor Ben Dubose. How's it going today, Ben?
Pretty well. How are you, Jackson?
You know, I can't complain. A bit of a long day at work, but now I'm at home. I'm chatting with you. I'm wearing my Rockets jammies, and I'm good to go for this podcast, man.
I like it. It's so much more fun to talk the last two or three weeks than it was, say, in January when they had that four-game losing streak, 5 of 6. Things have picked up in a big way these last, really, I don't even know if it's since the Covington trade. It's really since they went full-time small ball, which was before the Covington trade, and now ever since the trade deadline, things have really accelerated in a good way.
Absolutely. Rockets small ball, which I guess we can go and get our first question out of the way from our Rockets mailbag, is from at Brit Robotista, which everybody should know Brit by now. But Brit asked, you know, is it, you know, a week or so later, is it still small ball? Is it micro ball or pocket Rockets? Which you and I already discussed this, and I think we're on the same page. We both agree it's small ball, right?
Yeah, I think it's small ball. Other than who came up with micro USB? That was the one. Was that Salman Ali? I'm forgetting who came up with that.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think it was Salman Ali that did micro USB. I'm trying to search that right now. Someone was mentioning that. But yeah, for the USB connection, I gave that a little bit more credibility. But yeah, with us, I think small ball is more applicable, especially because of the Daryl Morey musical. Come on now.
All right. Well, we're going to stick with small ball for sure. So we can go ahead and knock that first one out of the way, but kind of just moving things along because we have a lot of questions to get to in this episode. We have our next question from at the Electrifying 2, so the Electrifying Phenom. Do you think missing out on Tristan Thompson and Markieff Morris will affect this team at all come playoff time?
So I think these are two separate questions. Tristan Thompson, no, only because I don't think he was ever attainable. His salary figure, close to $20 million, I forget if he's exactly 16 or 18, but he's way up there. The point is the Rockets couldn't trade for him. They had nowhere near the matching salary. And because his salary is so big, that's why Tristan Thompson is not getting bought out, because if he got bought out, he would give up his bird rights this summer, which even if he doesn't re-sign in Cleveland, his bird rights can open up a lot of sign and trade possibilities. And that's something that I believe Clutch Sports has never done a buyout, in part because of giving up those bird rights. So I just don't think he was ever attainable. It's hard to miss out on what you never had or had a chance at in this case. Markieff Morris, that's a fair question. I think a lot of it, quite frankly, is that the Rockets really believe in Jeff Green. I said last weekend that to me, there was never really an incentive to claim Markieff Morris just to block him from the Lakers, because you don't want a guy who's going to be your 11th or 12th man on the roster who's going to be unhappy. And of course, there's political consequences to double-crossing the agent, going against the player's wishes. We know that all things being equal, he wanted to be in L.A., I know he's shooting nearly 40% on threes, and if Jeff Green tails off, then sure, you can make that argument. But through three games, Jeff Green has been really good. He's got a lot of continuity, history with Russell Westbrook and James Harden. And so I think, to me, the Markieff Morris question is sort of intrinsically tied to the Jeff Green question. If you believe in Jeff Green as the backup center, and Mike D'Antoni has praised him repeatedly over the past week, then there's not really going to be a role for Markieff Morris. And politically, I just don't think it's really tenable to have Markieff Morris just sitting on your bench as number 11, number 12, as a just in case, you know, you break the glass type of thing. So to me, I lean no, but it depends on how legitimate Jeff Green is. If he holds up, you're not going to regret it. If this turns out to be fool's gold, and let's be real, the Knicks aren't a great opponent, and Jeff Green starts to regress, then maybe you do regret that. But to me, Green versus Morris, that's the debate.
You know, I agree. I'm firmly in the camp. I don't think, look, Daryl Morey has faced his fair share of political issues so far this season, and I feel like he wouldn't want to be in hot water with other GMs by claiming Morris off waivers and kind of ruffling feathers and whatnot, so to speak. So I think that kind of makes sense there. Now, I'm going to springboard this into another question that does have to do with Jeff Green. So from at @JQuanFu, so Justin Kwan, Jeff Green has shown out since he was picked up. Can we legitimately trust this renewed version of Green, or will we be disappointed and see him disappear from the rotation going into the playoffs? And I actually kind of talked about this a little bit already, that I think Gerald Green is a guy that has a legitimate chance to help win you a game or two in the playoffs, a la a Josh Smith type. What do you think, Ben?
You mean Jeff Green?
Oh, I said Gerald Green. You know what? It's because, look, my heart is missing Gerald Green, apparently. So we're just, that's why that Freudian slip happened, apparently. But
and you have the Greenhouse era that you can bring back, which is pretty amazing. That Greenhouse effect, that era is still potentially applicable in this situation. That's kind of amazing. I never thought we'd be able to say that again. But look, I like him. It's not just his ability to shoot. He's a versatile defender. He fits in well in that PJ Tucker mold. But what's really unique to me about Jeff Green, he can put the ball on the floor. He's not just a stationary shooter. We've seen some athleticism, and who knows, maybe at 33 years old, having the 2 months off between when he was let go in late December by the Jazz and until late February when he got his 10-day contract with the Rockets, maybe that makes him more spry going into the playoffs. I don't know, but we saw the poster dunk that he almost finished that would have ended that poor guy in the Knicks' career on Monday night. We've seen him, even though that one wasn't successful, we have seen him take it off the dribble, I believe, certainly against the Knicks, but also against the Jazz, with some success. The Warriors game, he made pretty much everything. And so to me, he's diverse enough. Sure, he's mobile, he can score, he can make three-pointers, but he can do things off the dribble as well. I don't know if he's the passer that Josh Smith was, but in terms of a big that has a diverse array of skills, I could see him in the playoffs being a weapon. And Mike D'Antoni does not throw out the type of praise that he has thrown out about Jeff Green all that often. By comparison, he's been much more muted about Jamari Carroll, not so much saying that Jamari Carroll has not played that well, but just acknowledging that it's an uphill climb for Carroll to get minutes. He doesn't want to set expectations too high. It's not just about the fans. It's also about the players in the locker room. Whereas with Jeff Green, he's gone out of his way multiple times, D'Antoni that is, to point out that there is a role for him with the Rockets, a key one, and that to me suggests that maybe things change. You have to see how he finishes the season over the last 6-7 weeks, however much we have left. But right now, the Rockets see a role for him down the stretch of the year and in the playoffs, and he has every opportunity to take advantage of it. And to me, could they be wrong? Certainly. But Mike D'Antoni, I think he's built up a lot of equity, especially the last month or so with how things have turned around with the fan base. I think the context clues are there. James Harden has given Jeff Green some rave reviews as well. I think the context is there that they believe in Jeff, and that to me gives it a chance that this can work in the playoffs.
For our next one, we're going to go to another, you know, new-ish Rocket. I say new-ish because he's new to the team this season, but from @Gabe, and Gabe, I'm sorry if I mess up your name, @Gabriel Moreau, I'm going to go with that. Are there certain playoff matchups where Ben McLemore is unplayable on D, or can he be hidden slash is his shooting too important? And I've been very vocal about my disdain for Ben McLemore's defense, especially in the last 2 weeks or so. So what do you think about that, Ben?
Absolutely, yes. There are some matchups to where he might can get played off unless he shoots at an unsustainable clip. I think what really proves this, the biggest game of the year was that Saturday win at Utah. They had to get it for standings, the tiebreaker, so many reasons. And even though McLemore made all four threes, he only played 13 minutes. And if you listen to Mike D'Antoni's postgame interview, he cited McLemore's defense in the first half as a big part of the problem. And some of it's not just effort. Some of it, look, he's 6'3", and unlike Eric Gordon, he doesn't really have that thick frame. So there's only so much that he can do. And the second unit, that's often when you're taking guys like certainly Robert Covington, PJ Tucker, they may not be out on the floor. Even James Harden, when the game matters, not having him on the court, that can be a big deal because James, we know that he can turn it up defensively in your statement games. And so it becomes much more difficult to hide a guy like McLemore. So right now, am I saying that he's going to fall out of the rotation? Not at all, because he's shooting insanely well. I think since early January, he's like over 46% from three. That's ridiculous. But the bar really is that high. He truly does have to shoot that well, or else you can see some of the defensive deficiencies becoming a problem, especially because you have someone now like Damari Carroll that's on that bench that can theoretically take a lot of those minutes but give you a lot better defense. He's bigger, those types of things. So with regards to McLemore, can he earn playoff minutes? Yes, but the bar is really high in terms of how well he has to shoot. The law of historical averages tells you that he may not hold that up. Now, if he continues the way he has in recent weeks, in which he's been, I believe, like a top five shooter in the NBA, then that's too good to remove. I totally get it. But if the law of averages kicks in and he gets on a cold stretch, and I know it feels like a distant memory, but keep in mind the first month of the year from late October until late November, Ben couldn't find ocean from a boat. He was really struggling. If he goes through a bit of a slump, then yeah, that defense makes him prone to be removed from the rotation. So not saying it's going to happen, but could it happen? Yes, absolutely.
I feel a little bit validated because I was receiving a little bit of pushback about everybody saying, you know, Ben McLemore's shooting's too important. He's got to stay in the rotation. So thank you, Ben. I feel a little bit validated in my concerns regarding his defense.
Yeah, I mean, I love him. He's so fun because his rhythm, when he is on, his form, he is so fun to watch. Ben McLemore, and his story, he's such an easy guy to cheer for, a guy that was perceived to be a bust, and now he's kind of reinvented his career. He's obviously a big favorite of James Harden. He's under contract for next year as well. So there's a lot of reasons to like Ben McLemore, and I do as well. With that said, the bar to be in the playoff rotation for this team is really high. Keep in mind, that Saturday game at Utah I was referencing, you had two accomplished veterans in Damari Carroll and Thabo Sefolosha who did not play at all. The bar is really high. When they're healthy, you've got 11 guys, and that's not even counting Bruno, that could theoretically give you legitimate minutes. So it's not an insult at Ben McLemore. I think that's where a lot of people on Twitter take it the wrong way. When you suggest that Ben McLemore might not be in the rotation, they take it as somewhat of an insult. No, it's not about that. It's just that now, all of a sudden, now that they filled those roster spots, you got rid of Gerald Green and Nene, who were kind of anchors simply because of their injuries, and now you've brought in guys like Damari Carroll, like Jeff Green. All of a sudden, the bar to be in the rotation is really high. Now, if Ben McLemore continues to shoot like he has for the last 6 weeks or so, no doubt, he's going to be out there. But if he slumps a little bit, yeah, you can see a case. And while I hope that doesn't happen, maybe it doesn't. His shooting rhythm the last couple of months has been beautiful. At the same time, just NBA history tells you you have to be prepared for it to maybe even out a little bit. And then if it does, then yeah, it would not floor me if a guy like Damari Carroll starts to steal some of those minutes.
All right, we've got plenty more questions from you guys to answer, and we will get to those questions in just one moment. But first, we have a quick word from our friends over at Indeed. When you start your hiring process, you may have questions. Will you find good applicants to choose from? What about education and experience? And how will you know that you've made the right hire? Indeed is here to help. Millions of great candidates use Indeed every day to find their next opportunity. You can post a job in minutes and use screener questions to help create your shortlist of applicants fast. You can also add skills tests to your job posts so that you can be confident in your applicants' abilities. Their library of more than 50 skills tests ranges from industry-specific skills like accounting to general aptitude tests like critical thinking. Indeed gives you the smart tools to make hiring decisions quickly and to be confident that you're making the right hire for your team. Post your job today at Indeed.com/LockedOn and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/LockedOn. Terms, conditions, and exclusions apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020. And we are back in here at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball. Chatting with Rockets Wire editor Ben DuBose. All right, Ben, so we've got our very next question. So at Calvin Marcus, so your pal Cal, which is an awesome Twitter name, I should say, asks, will Damari Carroll crack the rotation when Westbrook returns? Or I guess this was immediately after a game that Westbrook sat out. But when he returns, why or why not? And do you see him playing important minutes in the playoffs?
Potentially. I think that Carroll's role is more of a hedge on McLemore and House. We talked a little bit about McLemore earlier. Can he continue to shoot this well? If he doesn't, he's a bit of a decline on the defensive end. With House, it's more of a bigger picture going back to last offseason question with regards to, you know, I know he's been in rhythm for the last month or so, but think back to early January. There's a reason why House got pulled from the starting lineup, and it's reminiscent a little bit of what happened in the playoffs against the Warriors. I know he had the toe situation, but he's still relatively young and unseasoned. And so I think what Carroll does, he provides you a hedge a little bit on McLemore and House. So some of it is to be determined based on exactly how those other two guys fare. In terms of what Carroll can do, I think he's looked pretty good. You know, he got in the Knicks game because, as the question mentioned, Westbrook's injury, that was a big part of it. So I'm understanding that when Westbrook comes back, in theory, that absorbs some of those minutes. But Carroll, he's looked pretty spry to me in terms of his defensive ability to move laterally. He showed against the Knicks a nice ability, I thought, to attack the bucket in a couple of instances. I've been pretty impressed with Damari with the limited sample we've seen. Also, that first game against the Warriors in which he literally just got signed like 90 minutes before the game. I think Damari has potential. I just don't know that shooting-wise, he has quite the upside of Ben McLemore or the athleticism of Daniel House. So I think in a perfect world, he might be insurance depth in the playoffs, because I think when House is clicking, he can be really, really good. And if Ben McLemore shoots the way he has the last 6 weeks, I think they have higher upside than Damari Carroll. And then, of course, at the center spot, I'm assuming that's between Tucker, occasional Covington, and then Jeff Green, as we've talked about. I think that's kind of your minutes at the five. So I think Carroll, in a perfect world, if everyone is clicking, he might not have the upside as your other guys. But in a more practical sense, could I see him in the rotation by the playoffs? Yes, absolutely. Just because I think in both cases, Ben McLemore and Daniel House Jr., there's some uncertainty with regards to their playoff history and how much you can truly expect to translate once you get to best of seven series against the best teams in the NBA.
You know, it's a good thing we mentioned that you mentioned just now, PJ Tucker at the center spot for the Rockets, because our very next question actually involves PJ Tucker. So at J White Stripes, so Johnson White, will the Rockets look to extend PJ? I feel like this is a pretty self-explanatory question, but I think it just depends on kind of the monetary value of the contract that Tucker's looking for, right?
Yeah, the contract and how he plays in the playoffs. To me, that's by far the biggest thing to watch for. Because with PJ, it's not so much that they don't want to reward him. It's just very difficult for a guy who's going to turn 35 years old in a couple of months to believe, based on traditional NBA aging curves, that he's going to be worth extending. And keep in mind, when his current deal runs out next summer, he's going to be 36. Now, to be fair to PJ, he keeps himself in phenomenal shape. He has already defied the traditional aging curve to a large extent, because most guys aren't as good, especially defensively, as PJ is right now at 34, about to turn 35. So who's to say that he can't keep doing this? We have seen some players be the exception to the rule. That said, the rule is there for a reason. And so I think what Daryl Morey said last summer was that, with rare exceptions like James Harden, their mentality in terms of the Rockets front office, they wait until a year out to where it makes sense for both sides in terms of what the player and his agent think is fair value for them and what the team sees as fair value, aka what they are willing to commit to. And I think last summer, having a guy who's 34 years old and 2 years, two seasons out, it's too tough to project his value. If PJ Tucker, we've seen what he's done this regular season, he's been really good. If he holds up in the postseason as well, and you're only 1 year as opposed to two, then yeah, I could see the Rockets being willing to take the gamble. So to me, it's a combination of things. First off, the dollar value has to be there. But then beyond that, from the Rockets standpoint, they want to see how he holds up in the playoffs. To this point, so far, so good. But if there's any sort of kind of hint at maybe PJ is aging a little bit by the playoffs, then that decreases the odds of a deal. Because the main obstacle is just, from the Rockets standpoint, they want to make sure that, hey, if we're giving an extension to a guy who's going to be 36 years old when he gets that extension, most NBA players are not very good at that point. So we want to be as convinced as we can that this guy is still going to be a really good NBA player. And I think the NBA playoffs are where we'll learn a lot when we see PJ against really the best of the best when it comes to big men in the Western Conference.
So keeping things in line with a lot of the playoff-related questions, which there are a lot of playoff-related questions, and obviously we're headed into that stretch of the season where we are pretty much concerned with, you know, seeding, how they're going to fare against the other playoff teams. But at Oh, goodness. Y'all are giving me some really difficult Twitter handles to pronounce. All right. At Amujica24. And then, yeah, so there we go. How will the spacing be different in the playoffs? According to the national media, opposing teams will minimize it. But honestly, how? And this kind of reminds me of, in a way, how the Raptors essentially shrunk the court against Giannis in last year's playoffs. And so that might be obviously Giannis is a different beast than the Rockets' spacing, but there are ways to kind of shrink a court and to make things more difficult for a team that relies on shooting as many threes as the Rockets do. We've seen them be run off the three-point line before, right?
This would have been a much better question when the Rockets had Clint Capella, or when they were playing Nene as the backup, as they were even a year ago, and he was a bit of the hedge if you worried that Clint was too unseasoned in a given matchup. Right now, I'm not really sure what the answer is, unless the Rockets just go catastrophically 0-27 cold. I hate to bring that up, but we do have to acknowledge it as a possibility. That's when you go that three-point heavy, you do have variance both good and bad. But to me, when you have truly five out, and I know Russell Westbrook isn't really a three-point shooter, although, by the way, Russell has shot low to mid-30s the last couple of weeks. It's a small thing, but he was a lot better after the All-Star break last year in Oklahoma City as he got into rhythm after offseason knee surgery. Maybe that same thing is happening again. That would mean a whole heck of a lot if you can't sag off Russ, if he can just shoot, not even saying he needs to shoot great, just low to mid-30s, something to be respectable. But even if he's the guy that he's been most of this year, around 25%, he's so lethal attacking the bucket, especially if you have to respect the center all the way out to the three-point line. So to me, it's just finding the right balance. To me, if the Rockets can find that, but that's the question. You know, we talked earlier about McLemore, House, Carroll, who's in rhythm, and trying to find the right balance between making enough threes on offense and having the right defense and physicality on the other end. It's finding that balance. If you don't, then sure, there's some scenarios that you can kind of compress the court. But otherwise, assuming you find that right balance with your role players, it's just going to be pretty difficult, because it's not like the Rockets with Clint Capella, where then you have at least one spot that you can clearly sag off. And we've seen, even if you do sag off Russell Westbrook entirely, he is so uniquely lightning quick with his ability to drive. Even with Rudy Gobert sagging off at 7'1", he's still able to score 30-plus mid-30s a game with his attacking mindset. So it's not like just because Russell Westbrook's a non-shooter, no, that's not the same as, say, Clint Capella, a non-shooter. Not even close, because Russell Westbrook can create. So to me, I think the analysts are way oversimplifying it, because they don't recognize or appreciate the uniqueness in a good way of what the Rockets are doing. To me, it's just a question of finding the right balance in the role players, because if you optimize things correctly, certainly Ben McLemore could be an asset on that end. It's going to be pretty impossible to shut down the spacing, but then it gets into, you know, how much with your role players can you get offensively while not being a downside defensively, and can you find the right balance there? To me, that's the big question.
I definitely don't envy Mike D'Antoni, who gets paid the big bucks to make these decisions and to try and find the balance in his rotations, but keeping things going, our next question comes from @Chris_Davis. So, which team out of the Thunder, Mavericks, or Pelicans would you want to avoid in the first round? And I like Chris's question here by just nominating the Pelicans, who are currently three games out of a playoff spot. He's sticking them in the playoff, you know, in the playoff race. I appreciate that, Chris.
To me, there's an easy answer to that, and I appreciate throwing the Pelicans in, because the Grizzlies, it feels like, especially with their injuries, they might be going the other way at the moment. To me, it's easily the Mavs, because we have seen over the course of this season, I know they've tailed off a little bit with the Luka injury over the past month, but when they're right, the Mavs have been a historically elite offense. Luka can be a true difference maker. If they get hot from the perimeter, there's just not a whole heck of a lot that you can do about it, even if you're a really good team. So they scare me if they're in the 6-7 spot, something like that. I don't want the Mavs. And also, selfishly, there's the Houston-Dallas rivalry. If you lose to Dallas with Luka at 20 and Russell Westbrook and James Harden in their 30s, you will never hear the end of it. And there is no case, if you lose to Luka at 20 and with your guys in their 30s, to how things are going to get better. That would be an awful narrative. So I don't want to chance it. I also think they have a lot of upside against anyone if they're healthy. So I'd rather just not go against the Mavericks. To me, I respect so much what they've done, but I honestly wouldn't mind playing the Thunder. I know there's a lot of Rockets fans, and I respect so much what Chris Paul has done. I know it'd be awful if Russell Westbrook lost to the Thunder, if Chris Paul beat the Rockets, yada, yada. To me, the Thunder are a great regular season team. They play with focus every single night. They do a lot of little things, but I don't really see the upside in the playoffs in terms of difference makers that can take over an individual game. To me, they're a little bit simplified. They don't have the extra gear that the Mavs do. The Pelicans, I honestly have no idea. The sample size with Zion is so small. it's tough to read them. I can pick up that discussion in a couple of weeks when we see if their recent surge continues, if they really get into the mix, because they still have three games to make up on Memphis. But to me, Dallas is the scariest. Oklahoma City, I don't want that to sound like a slight. I respect them, but they're just not in the same gear when it comes to upside. As opposed to Dallas, say what you will, but for long stretches of this season, this has been one of the best offenses in NBA history. And ideally, I'd prefer to avoid that in round one, especially adding the rivalry aspect to that as well.
Can you imagine the sparks between, I know we've talked about a Clippers Rockets playoff series, but imagine the sparks in a Rockets Thunder playoff first round series.
Oh yeah, geez, the storyline to be off the charts.
Absolutely. All right, well, we've got still a handful of questions to answer here in the final segment, and we'll hit those questions in just one moment, but we're going to hit this break first and be right back. And we are back in here for our final segment at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day, chatting with Rockets Wire editor Ben DuBose, going through our Rockets mailbag. And so we will jump straight in to our very next question. So from at PJ Lynch, Patrick James Lynch. So given some of their unique challenges, do you think that D'Antoni, Harden, and Russ are schematically quote-unquote holding anything back until the playoffs, or is it more important for everyone to get it right, get in rhythm, scheming versus prepping? And I find this question kind of funny because it reminds me of two things. One, it reminds me of, I don't know if you're a Marvel guy, Ben, but it reminds me of in Captain America Civil War, Tony Stark is saying, you know, does anybody else have any, you know, hidden secret powers that they would like to unveil right now? Because I don't think that's going to happen, but it also kind of reminds me of Tim Duncan shooting a three-pointer in the playoffs years ago. So maybe that was like the secret weapon that he kind of had in mind. I don't know where to kind of go with this. I think they're doing everything that they can do right now to win, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They gave away too many games early in the year to schematically hold something back. And that's not really Mike D'Antoni ball anyway. Mike D'Antoni ball on offense is about basically opening up the floor and giving your stars the best chance that they can to maximize their abilities. It's not like you see a lot of plays called up from the sidelines by Mike D'Antoni. No, a lot of what the D'Antoni Rockets era is about is freelancing and giving your guys, your playmakers, a chance to make plays and spreading the floor for them as best you can. To me, if there's something that's being saved, it's not so much tactically, but I think defensively, you'll see them turn it up a notch in the playoffs. Maybe something to do with their schemes. That's more Elston Turner than Mike D'Antoni, but we've seen in the past they've done some new things in the playoffs and terms of their exact coverages. But more than that, I think it's less tactical. It's more just energy. Over the grind of a regular season, what you're asking your veterans that have a huge offensive workload like James Harden and Russell Westbrook to take on, I think in the last couple of postseasons, we've seen James Harden a lot better on defense in the playoffs, in part because he knows the games are bigger. Also, there's no back-to-backs. You have all this time off in between games. And so I think in the playoffs, Harden and maybe Westbrook as well, because we've seen Westbrook isn't always dialed in, but he still has the athletic ability to be a really good defender at times. He doesn't get caught ball watching. He can be really disruptive in the passing lanes. So I think it's less schematic, but defensively, you can see those two guards that have such a high offensive workload in the regular season. It's too much to ask them to be dialed in defensively night after night. In the playoffs, they can be. So that's why I do think, just in a general sense, the Rockets, their defensive principles, they're an undersized team. We know that, small ball, micro ball, whatever you want to call it. Well, the trick with that, with the back-to-backs, the grind of an 82-game season, you can't play your best every single night. You try to, but it's just not reasonable. There's logistics factors with that. You get to the playoffs, however, where the games are more spread out, and with your veterans, you know they kind of have to manage themselves over the 6 months, 7 months, however long it is in the regular season. Those guys, Harden, Westbrook, PJ Tucker, Robert Covington, Eric Gordon, we can throw them in there as well. They can bring their best on a regular basis in the playoffs. And I don't know if that's a tactical adjustment. I think it's more just effort from day to day. But to me, that's what's going to be different. And maybe that disproportionately benefits the Rockets, because whereas a lot of teams are dependent on their athleticism defensively, Jackson, in terms of just how well they can rebound, how well they can contest, with the Rockets playing as small as they are, it's about effort. And I think with the playoffs, the schedule, the intensity, that might disproportionately benefit a veteran team a little bit more. So I'll say not so much offensive. Defensively, maybe, but it's less tactical and it's more just really the realities of how the Rockets want to play.
Counterpoint, Russell Westbrook is an all-time great shooter and he's secretly been sleeping on that ability this entire time and will unleash it come playoffs.
Wow. There you go. I like it.
All right. Well, and it kind of also to build on your point, you know, I've made that same point where it's, you know, now everything is so, it is effort centric, especially now that you're playing small ball. In a way, you know, it allows, at least, and this is my opinion of it so far, small ball allows these players now to really, on a nightly basis, go all out without necessarily having to worry about who's the next man up in the rotation, as far as a traditional rotation where, say, Clint Capella has to, you know, understand his backup is out there on the court, and then his backup has to be able to play a certain number of minutes before Clint can come back in and, you know, catch his breath, that kind of thing. It's just next man up, because really the only two guys that have to replace each other in the rotation now are James and Russ at their respective rest times in each game.
Yep.
So in a way, I think it allows these guys to really go more all out, because it's just, you're out there, you give 110%. When it's time for a substitution, it's just the next guy on the court, because you're essentially playing positionless basketball anyways.
Yep.
All right. So for our very next question, we've got at Brett and a bunch of numbers. Brett, you know I'm not good at math. This is not cool. Brett 8826 9821. I made it. Okay. Do you think that having Russ by Harden's side through the playoffs, that Russ can bring even more out of Harden to get him to do things we haven't seen before? This is kind of open-ended.
Yeah. I don't know from a mental standpoint, but I think just from a physical standpoint, having some guy that can take over down the stretch of a game, there have been moments in the past, even in the playoffs, where the burden on Harden is so high. I think back to that Spurs series that's now almost 3 years old, but we know how that ended, to where it does feel like there's a cumulative fatigue, a mileage impact. Whereas with Russell Westbrook, there are legitimate possessions where you can give Harden the chance, I don't know if you take it off, but at the very least to be a spot-up shooter. Especially last year with Chris Paul, there was never that opportunity. James Harden, at least the threat, had to be involved in the offense, because no one else athletically really had the ability to create, except for Eric Gordon, in a very small dose. With Russell Westbrook, I don't know attitude-wise, because I think a lot of people misunderstand James Harden. It's not that he's not dialed in. He's just, he comes off a little bit as aloof if you don't know him. I don't know that rah-rah is that big of a deal, or that it ever was for James. I think he wants to win a title really, really bad. He's locked in focus-wise, and people that think otherwise just don't really understand his personality. But in terms of just the actual physics of surviving four best of seven playoff series, which even if they're not back-to-back, it can get a little bit exhausting, then sure, I think it can help having another guy that can create his own offense. And so maybe late in a competitive series, certainly you diversify the offense. There's more guys the defense has to respect. But more than that, because defenses are going to know track records going into the series, I think it's also just the ability that, hey, Russell Westbrook can give James Harden the occasional possession off, and then maybe James is a little bit more fresh towards the end of games and has the ability to tap into that extra gear the same way we saw, say, Kawhi Leonard do without at various points in the playoffs. Not consistently, but when the moments really matter, we saw Kawhi just sort of take over these games with the Raptors last season. Maybe that's something that James Harden can tap into if he's a little bit more fresh with Russell Westbrook this postseason.
Kind of keeping things focused on Beard and Brody for a moment, from our Locked On email, Tri Lee asked, you know, and we spoke at length at the beginning of the season about this, some of the stylistic differences between Harden and Westbrook. Harden, more methodical, a bit more calculated. Westbrook, you know, very explosive, relies on his speed, you know, gets out in transition, all those kinds of things. So she asked, you know, I think in the playoffs, teams will have a harder time adjusting to two different, you know, stylistic offenses. And I think this question is even more important now, because Russell Westbrook essentially is still able to play the way that we thought he would, you know, when he was first traded to the Houston Rockets. But now he's effectively your center on offense, scoring all the paint points, operating out of the post. So I think it is, I agree, I think it's going to be difficult for teams to kind of game plan for two very, you know, different offenses at their core, right? Because it's just completely different with two guys.
I think it's absolutely true that it can be, but the onus is going to be on James Harden to continue playing at a clip that at least is respectable in the open court. And what I mean by that is Harden, if he's not running the floor, at least isn't lagging in the backcourt, makes it open to where the Rockets can push. Because what's happened a lot in the last postseasons, and a lot of it gets pushed onto Chris Paul because he was the older guy, but I think James Harden also preferred the slowdown. He's what Daryl Morey has called the best isolation player of all time. And so the way historically NBA playoff series tend to kind of devolve into just these one-on-one battles in the half court, I think James Harden is okay with that. I think Chris Paul was a part of the reason for the Rockets to slow down their pace in the regular season and especially in the playoffs, but I think James Harden is comfortable with that as well. And so on paper, do I like diversifying the offense? Yes, absolutely. It's a good thing. However, I do think it's going to have to be something that James Harden is reminded of, that he needs to run in those minutes that he and Westbrook are on the floor. He needs to be willing to run the floor as well, even if he's not the guy finishing. if he's lagging in the backcourt, it's going to make it all the more easier to defend Westbrook because you're not having to respect the best offensive player in the NBA if he's on the other side of half court. So I would say that on paper, yeah, it makes a ton of sense. In practice, it should work out that way, but you just have to remind James Harden of that tendency because historically, James Harden has been a very slow playoff player. I understand why. He's been paired with Chris Paul, who's been in his 30s. Also, James, one of the best offensive players of all time in his own right. But to maximize Russell Westbrook and to maximize that threat, you're going to have to see James Harden have the fitness to run up and down the floor with him to bring his man to make the other defense truly respect that. So, yes, it can happen. It should happen. But James Harden is going to have to make an effort to consciously kind of be involved in that as well.
I will also add to that, I think it's also a bit on Russ to not fall into being happy to play isolation ball as well. As long as he maintains the mentality of being aggressive, you know, continuing to power his way to the rim to overpower weaker guards, depending on how the opposing team is guarding him, I think that will keep things, you know, keep defenses on their toes, so to speak.
Yep.
All right. So for our next question, at TWalsh713, Mr. T-Dub, do you think MDA will be forced to go big at some point during a playoff series or even at some point during the regular season? Hang on. I got this one, Ben. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I just, it's not going to happen. You know, MDA's default is usually to go smaller, if anything. And I think there's zero reason, zero evidence to think that he would, you know, break out Tyson Chandler at this point. I think Tyson Chandler is basically just going to be a locker room presence at this point, and Isaiah Hartenstein has been banished to the G League.
And I'll add that over the past month, they played the Lakers with Anthony Davis. They played the Jazz with Rudy Gobert. They played the Mavs with Kristaps Porzingis. They have played three teams with this 6'5" PJ Tucker at center lineup, and they have held up really well. In fact, they've won all but one of those games, the one they lost to the Jazz on the buzzer beater from Bogdanović. So we've had plenty of evidence against really good teams that are big and taking these games incredibly seriously that the Rockets can hold up just fine. And if they've done it thus far, I don't really see Mike D'Antoni being the type to panic and do something different in the playoffs.
All right. From at @FF_pickups, what would constitute a successful season for the Rockets?
Boy, that's tough.
It is.
In terms of what they consider successful, I know this is going to seem harsh, but I say at least the NBA Finals. Now, I'm not saying that that's successful from a fan perspective. The Western Conference is really good, but when James Harden is 30, Russell Westbrook is 31, it would be a bitter pill to swallow losing the finals, but Milwaukee, at least on paper, is historically good. When you look at their record, it would be hard to argue that if you lose to a team like that, that something is terribly wrong. With that said, when you consider the first-round picks they've given up in the future as part of the Chris Paul for Russell Westbrook trade, when you consider how close they've been to the Warriors the last 2 years, they've been to the Western Conference Finals, they've been to Game 7, it's tough to say a season was a success unless they take a step closer. Now, that should mean a championship. I think it's possible. That leads into one of our next questions. But if they don't win a championship, I think to consider it a success, the only way you can really make that argument is if they lose to the Bucks, or maybe if they lose to the Lakers, and the Lakers have such a dominant playoff run that we say that, hey, this is a really historically great team. And that would be kind of a tough pill to swallow because I know we say the same thing about losing to the Warriors. They're a historically great team, yada, yada. But at least on paper, you can make the argument. If they lose, I don't care if it's in the second round, Western Conference Finals, if they lose to, say, the Denver Nuggets or someone along those lines, it's not a success. It's just not. I don't care how deep it is. The Rockets have too much of an investment cost, and at their ages, with, again, most of these guys 30 or above, Robert Covington 29, there's no real reason to think they're going to get a lot better. Maybe they get a little bit better with continuity, but the players, if anything, they might slip a little bit athletically. It's tough to say that anything is a success from their perspective unless they win the championship or get really, really damn close. That's tough, but that's just the reality of having two MVPs that are 30 and 31 years old.
I'm glad you backtracked there a little bit because I was getting ready to have to jump in and say, you know what? I do think that if they do make it to the Western Conference Finals and they do have the Lakers sitting there waiting for them and they make it a competitive series, either, you know, at least 6 or 7 games, I think that you can look at the season as a success by just looking at how you proved that small ball could be effective. And I think that in itself, in a vacuum, can be viewed as a success because then moving forward, you've changed the identity of NBA basketball as it stands. I mean, yes, there are other teams that have been playing, you know, a brand of positionless basketball, but you've really taken it to the next level and you've embraced the Mike D'Antoni and Daryl Morey vision with small ball. And I think that can be viewed as a success if you don't make it to the finals.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I think the calculus changed a little bit with the stylistic trade when you went from Clint Capella to Robert Covington and all in on this small ball. You have to do something that gives yourself hope moving forward. And while I think you know, with Harden and Westbrook going to be 31 and 32 next year, it's tough to say they'll get a lot better. But you can make an argument if they at least come close and they lose to a championship team that's really, really good, then maybe year two of this experiment, getting a full training camp, maybe you'll bring D'Antoni back. You'll have to see exactly how that goes. If you go deep into the playoffs, I think it certainly increases the odds of Mike coming back. And at that point, even if you don't get better athletically, maybe you get better continuity-wise. So I shouldn't say it's impossible. But yeah, the bottom line is the bar is high. Maybe it's not quite as high as NBA Finals or bust, but it's pretty high either way.
Moving on to our next question, which is another loaded question from at Sam Christensen. Christensen? We're going to go Christensen. Do you legitimately think the Rockets can win a championship this season?
It depends on what you mean by legitimately. Can they? Yes. I think they're one of a few teams that I could really see having a chance. They have that type of upside, and they have the variance based on how they went small at the deadline. Do I expect them to? No. It gets into kind of what I talk about a lot on Twitter, which is that you can't really have an expectation to be the best team of 30, or even in the case of the NBA playoffs, the best of 16. That is really tough to do. Everybody is trying to do the same thing, so you can't look at it from the sense of entitlement. Even the Bucks, who are historically great, I don't think the Bucks are better than 50-50 to win the title. So when we say the Rockets can legitimately win the title, do I think they can? Yes. I think they are one of probably four teams that I think could. Milwaukee,
so it's gotta
the
be, Okay.
Lakers, the Clippers, and I'd say the Rockets are in the top four with them. I don't really see any of the others having that type of gear. So I will say that, do the Rockets have a chance? Yes. But when I say legitimately have a chance, I'm counting, I don't know, 10, 20% as legitimate. Because with regards to being the best team, especially in a sport where you got to win four best of seven series, win 16 games in the Western Conference, you could easily lose in round one. That's really tough to do. So can they? Yes. I certainly think they have the upside with two former MVPs who have played great at different points this season and fortunately in recent games, pretty well together. And you also have the variance with the small ball style. The defense has picked up some over the last couple of weeks since they've made these changes. So can they? Yes. But it comes down to what do you mean by legitimately. If you count legitimately as I do, which means, yeah, you're one of the four or five best teams in the NBA, do you have a 10, 20% shot? Yes, absolutely. If you're expecting them, are you saying, is it more likely than not? No, but I don't think anybody's more likely than not. So I think it's just important to define exactly what legitimate means.
And I think we're both in agreement here, right? If we had to rank those four teams that you listed off by their favorability to win the title, I feel like it'd probably go Bucks, Lakers, and then maybe Rockets, Clippers about on the same tier as
yeah,
it stands right
reasonable.
Now.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. For our next question, so should things go as we all hope that they will, at AKInfinity_VVS, whose name on Twitter is Rocket Launchers 2020 NBA Champs, which is a very exciting name, which media member will get the most slander if the Rockets win the chip?
I think it's easy, and I'm taking kind of the low-hanging fruit, but it's got to be Bill Simmons, because I've just been so appalled the last couple of weeks. I know it's fairly recent, but look, what the Rockets are doing, this is fun. They are going outside the box. They're playing, as you mentioned, a historically unique way. Whether it works or it doesn't, this is fun. This is something that is different than the norm, and even if I weren't a Rockets guy, I would be intrigued to see how this experiment plays out. You've got two former MVPs, two superstars in their 30s that have not won a title yet. They are pushing. Their legacies, to some extent, are on the line. Now, they'll still be great players if they don't win a title, but they'd be in that Karl Malone, Charles Barkley type tier. Can they win a title and become an all-time great? That type, which they probably need a title, at least one, to get to. That's what they're playing for. Stylistically, what Mike D'Antoni is doing, he hasn't won a title yet. A 6'5" center. This would be so fascinating. And so that's why I'm just so perplexed to see Bill Simmons, these takes that what the Rockets are doing is bad for basketball. No, it's fascinating to see if this can work. So many in the NBA, it's a copycat league. To see someone, it would be so uplifting if the Rockets could win it this way and open up really an entire new era in terms of ways you can build teams. It would be so fun. Daryl Morey hasn't won a championship yet. We'll throw him in there. So to me, if the Rockets win it all and open up the possibility that teams not really built like traditional contenders can win it all, I think it's great for the NBA, and I think it makes it even easier to poke fun at Bill Simmons and say, what the hell were you thinking in February when you acted like this was bad for the NBA? I think this is great. I think it's great no matter what because they're entertaining. It's different. I don't know how anyone can watch these games the last couple of weeks and not be entertained by what the Rockets are doing, the shooting, the ball movement, which is really picked up, the defense, how they communicate, how they move. But if they win it all, then it really just highlights how ridiculous some of these reactionary takes are because the Rockets, if nothing else, they're entertaining. And I think they should be applauded for taking the risk and doing something outside of the box.
I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there too. Chris Webber can, you know, can also get a little bit of slander for just the number of times that he was appalled that the Rockets didn't have a center in play the very first day after the trade took place. I mean, just I still can hear him in my mind, you know, going, you know, the Rockets don't have a center, so you know, how are they going to defend at the basket? Meanwhile, Robert Covington is averaging like 2.6 blocks per game over the last four games.
Yeah.
Had to get tested because they think that he's maybe juicing because he's blocking so many shots right at the rim.
Yeah, no doubt. 15 blocks in four games. That's absurd.
Yeah. So, all right. And kind of ending things on a bit of a, you know, kind of a nostalgic note. So at RyNelson1101, Ryan Nelson, favorite Rockets moment or game or both from this season? I have two in mind. So I'll let you go first, Ben, and then I'll wrap it up.
So I've got two, and they were within a four-day span. And I know there's some recency bias at play. I'm going to throw out one that people remember for a horrible reason, but I think if they end up making a deep run, you'll remember that Utah game, the Sunday that they lost on the Bogdanovich buzzer beater. And I know a lot of people are going to say, how could you think about that as a favorite moment slash game? Well, not so much the game, but the moment, the two threes in the last 30 seconds. That was a big game. Keep in mind, the Rockets, fortunately, we can look back with a smile now because they beat the Jazz this past Saturday. They got the tiebreaker anyway, but they wanted that tiebreaker. They were playing hard. After they went down by 7 with 3 minutes left, to see Robert Covington and PJ Tucker stick those two threes in the final 30 seconds, down by 2 both times, or I think down by 2 once, down by 1 the other time. But the point is, with everything on the line, to see them, that was the epitome of Clutch City. Those were incredible shots under a ton of pressure. I get that it didn't end that well, but I'm kind of the rare fan. I can look back. I know a lot of Rockets fans will never look back at the 2018 Western Conference Finals. I will. I enjoy looking back to Game 5 before the Chris Paul injury, or Game 7, even without Chris Paul, I got up by 15 points in the first half. I'm weird that way because I can remember how it felt in that moment. To me, sports are about moments, and so to see PJ and Covington, two of your role players, step up and make those types of shots against an elite opponent on a big stage to see the crowd at Toyota Center. I know it ended horribly, but that was the type of moment that gets you to buy in that this team can really get it done. It sucks how it ended because Bogdanovich made an almost impossible shot, but the Rockets did what they could down the stretch of that game, and so that was kind of the clutch thing. It makes you think that maybe they have the gene that can become a championship. And then the other one, it's easy, but the Laker game. The day after the Covington trade, to see all the talk from Barkley, Shaq, you mentioned Chris Webber in your last segment, to go out against one of the big boys, the number one in the Western Conference with Anthony Davis, and shut them down in their house, win by double digits the night after the trade. You could not shut up the haters more beautifully than that. You could not write a script. So to me, I know that's easy. You might have been thinking about that game as well, but you asked me first, so I went to that. But to me, that's the best game just because of the overall narratives and the best moment, even though it didn't end that way. I still like those shots from Covington and Tucker against the Jazz just because of kind of the symbolism of it. It gives me a lot of hope that those guys are ready to step up in the playoffs in those types of moments.
So, and I actually didn't have that game in mind, surprisingly. It was very close for me, but I didn't have that game in mind. So I'll start with my favorite game of the season, and it was the comeback win at home against the Spurs, where they were down, I want to say it was 25 at the half. And I remember that game so distinctly because it was essentially Russell Westbrook and nobody else for the first half of that game. Just, you know, Russ was just willing the Rockets to stay somewhat within, you know, striking. And I say striking distance, you're down 25 at half. But, you know, the NBA today, I guess being down 20 points is, you know, still striking distance, more or less. So Russell Westbrook wills the team along in that first half. And then James Harden shows up a bit, just enough in the second half to push them to victory. And so that was probably my favorite game so far this season, just because, one, you beat the Spurs. Two, it was the revenge game after the, you know, dunk gate from earlier this season. So it was really nice to get that win against them. And three, I'm just going to double down on it. You're beating the Spurs at home. Like, I will never get enough enjoyment out of beating the Spurs and or the Mavericks anytime, anywhere. But so that was my favorite game. My favorite moment, and this actually goes all the way back to opening night, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
Was Russell Westbrook spearheading the assault in the fourth quarter in what was almost a comeback for the Houston Rockets. And this kind of falls in line with what you were saying about the Utah Jazz game, where you appreciate those moments where you can see glimpses of what this team could be and how good they could be. And seeing Russell Westbrook kind of take over down the line in a game where James Harden struggled and really almost bring them to the victory, almost secure the W. Yes, they lost that game. Yes, it was disappointing watching Brook Lopez take advantage of PJ Tucker in the post, but watching what Russ was able to do, to see a guy really take over a game that wasn't James Harden in a Rockets jersey, knowing full well that the season prior, you know, we saw some issues with Chris Paul not being able to step up to the plate, I should say, and be that guy, at least not as frequently as we needed him to be. To see Russ do that in his very first regular season game as a Rocket, it was exciting, and it's, you know, it kind of set the tone for the season a little bit.
No doubt. And against a Milwaukee team that we didn't necessarily know because it's opening night how great they would be. But I think we feel pretty confident saying that's a historically elite Bucks squad now. And so that's a good memory that even when Harden had a terrible game, I think he was 2 of 13, to see Westbrook play that way and keep you competitive in the fourth quarter or almost bring you back. Yeah, it's a way back, but that's a pretty good recall. I'm admitting that mine are a little more recency biased because I'm kind of defining the season by the switch to small ball. But yeah, if you think back to the grand scheme, Harden and Westbrook, that's a really encouraging one. Maybe we're a little bit biased to the things that are new, small ball, Westbrook, because certainly Harden has had some games. What he's done in those two games against the Clippers at Staples Center, think back to the end of December and early January, those two games at Toyota Center against the Nuggets and then the Sixer game. Those are two really good opponents. That Harden was just unbelievable. But I think some extent, we know that James Harden can do those things. Fair or unfair, we kind of take that for granted because that's what he's done for now 8 seasons largely in Houston. It's the new things. The small ball experiment, Russell Westbrook. To me, if you want to see this team win a championship, those are the biggest X factors. And so I think it's natural that, you know, we're kind of both drawn to that. Nothing against James Harden, but we know what James Harden can do. It's the other guys that are probably the X factors as it pertains to, can this team get over the hump in a way that the others the last couple of years have come so close, but ultimately not been able to do.
That was an extremely long podcast. I hope I don't get yelled at. But, we just wanted to answer every single one of y'all's questions. I don't think we skipped any over. And if I did, I apologize, but there were a lot of questions to get through. Now, Ben, you know the drill. Go ahead and plug your stuff before we get you out of here.
Yep, absolutely. I'll make it quick. Rockets Wire, you can go to rocketswire.usatoday.com, read day-to-day coverage of the team, follow the Rockets Wire on Twitter, or you can follow me on Twitter at Ben Dubose.
All right. Thanks, Ben. As always, we appreciate having you on.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
One more time for Mr. Ben Dubose of the Rockets Wire. Go give him a follow. Go give the Rockets Wire a follow if you're not already doing so. Always love having him here on the program. So with that, I hope you guys have enjoyed our extensive Mailbag Edition podcast. And as always, I look forward to having you guys back here very, very soon at Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast home for everything Houston Rockets basketball.